from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the modern history, the past year, of the Democratic Party in a nutshell. The stunning loss of the White House, recriminations, it was Hillary's fault, it was Bernie's fault, the calls for a reckoning, resistance, Nancy Pelosi's leadership under fire, the hunger for a comeback, and through it all, a seething debate about the right way forward, what to be, how to win again. This hour On Point, the Democrats' fire and their battle within. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see the Democrats now, the party, its face, its mission? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Janet Hook. She covers national politics for The Wall Street Journal. Her recent story is headlined, "Democrats Are United Against Trump, Divided on Everything Else." And by the way, we've got a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Janet Hook, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
United against Trump, I guess that's relatively easy. Divided on everything else, like what?
Well, mostly, as you referred to before, the way forward. I think one thing about the unity that they've had in fighting Trump is it's kind of postponed or masked the divisions that they have about what the strategy and message is going forward, just because the fight against Trump has had this urgency. And, you know, they were kind of thrilled when they managed to block the legislation to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But then when it comes to the question of what's the overarching positive agenda that the Democrats have, there's not as much unity.
There's plenty of enthusiasm, you report. You've got Democrats crowding into races for 2018 all over the country. Give us a sense of that, Janet.
Well, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, there's literally a record number of Democratic candidates running for the House, and they're coming from all walks of life, lots of people who've never had any political experience. It's sort of the wave of people who woke up after Election Day and said, wow, I got to do something. And for a lot of people, the something was running for office. Now, the problem with that is that a lot of them are attracted to the same House races, so that they're forming into these massive Democratic primaries of 4, 5, 7, 10 Democrats running against each other for the privilege of running against a House Republican who's considered vulnerable.
They need 24 seats to take back a majority in the House. Give us a sense of some of the races out there that are attracting big crowds of Democratic hopefuls.
Well, one thing you need to know in sizing up the Democratic battlefield, the places where they see opportunities, is while they need 24 seats to gain a majority, there are 23 House Republicans who are sitting in congressional districts that actually Hillary Clinton won. So the feeling is that there's a potential Democratic majority in sight there. So that's like top priorities lists. And a lot of those tend to be kind of suburban districts where there's a changing population, growing Latino populations. Like I went to a district in Houston. It's the western part of Houston where John Culberson is the incumbent. And it's been years since he'd had a serious challenge. And lo and behold, the Democrats woke up and saw that Hillary had won the district by only 1.4 percentage points. But then he suddenly became seen as vulnerable, and 6, 7 Democrats jumped into the race to run against him.
And that's just one. You say there are others that are really crowded. What about constituencies, districts that weren't Hillary-leaning, in fact, that may not be the kind of district that Democrats counted on in 2016?
Well, they still need to flip some of those, and those might pose some of the more the steeper challenges. One really interesting one that has gotten a lot of attention is the race against Paul Ryan. There's a Democrat who's running against him named Randy Brice, who's a very kind of colorful, compelling character. Big uphill climb there, but it kind of spotlights Democrats' interest in trying to challenge Republicans, even in territory that doesn't seem promising. I think the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has identified 80 districts that they want to have strong candidates in. That's a big battlefield.
There are splits in here. I mean, you remind us the candidates are split on Bernie Sanders' proposal to create a national single health payer health care system, about whether the party should focus on mobilizing its liberal base or trying to appeal to swing voters in the middle. You've got lackluster fundraising numbers from the Democratic National Committee. But we've got some kind of newcomers to the scene, or with a new framing anyway, in the resistance, so-called, who are doing well on fundraising. What about the divisive issues?
Well, I think in many ways, the biggest gaps are among Democrats are about strategy. There are some policy differences as well. Let's take the Bernie Sanders proposal on Medicare for All. That's his marquee proposal to provide universal health care. And a lot of Democrats say, well, I don't know about Medicare for All. Let's just have a more general statement of principle. Let's just say we want everybody to have affordable health care. That's partly a difference in policy. Maybe there's some Democrats who think that it goes too far to have government-provided health care for all citizens. But it's also for some a question of strategy. I may think that Medicare for All would be a good goal, but it's not practical. And in the meantime, we shouldn't be, you know, risking alienating centrist voters in these swing districts. But I think the Bernie Sanders strategists say that's the way Democrats have lost for generations, by temporizing and not stating clearly what they stand for and going for the best, not the most practical.
How does that get decided? I mean, we saw the passion of Sanders voters in 2016, their dissatisfaction in many ways, and we see what happened with Hillary Clinton. You quote Pete D'Alessandro, who ran the Sanders campaign in Iowa, now running himself in the 3rd District in Iowa, saying that, hashing this out, he said it'll be a Democratic family discussion. It won't be a family fight. We're going to decide what we're about, what we stand for. But it feels as though there's a lot to work out there, and it can often feel like more of a fight than a family discussion.
Yeah, I kind of wondered whether Pete D'Alessandro was being more hopeful than predictive. I think he'd like it to be a family discussion, but I think it, in many places, it will turn into a family fight. This being a midterm election year, it's hard to gauge the big national conversation among Democrats. There's each individual primary fight will have its own kind of dialogue among Democrats. In some places, it will be a clean shot of a Bernie Sanders-style progressive against a more centrist or establishment Democrat. The whole party is pretty much shifted to the left, but there are still differences between the center and the left. I think that probably the big fight and the real clearest debate won't come until the party starts looking for its presidential nominee for 2020. But I wrote that story and was interested in looking at primaries that are happening in the midterms just as kind of like a laboratory experiment. Let's see how these arguments are playing out in different districts in different parts of the country.
You quote Tom Davis, a former GOP congressman who was the Republican Party's national campaign committee chair, I guess, saying the Republicans had their Tea Party phase and the Democrats now have their herbal Tea Party phase. Can it work for them district by district? Can you be a kind of Sanders party in one district and a Clinton mainstream old centrist style party in another district, and that's no problem in the midterms?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I think it's definitely the case that different Democratic candidates can win on different messages in midterm elections from one district to the other. I think there's really not as much of a requirement for a unified national message when you've got districts as various as we have in the United States. I think what Tom Davis was getting at is that there's always a concern, and it's not unique to this time, that the party's primaries tend to drive their candidates. The competition among candidates in primaries tends to drive them to the ideological extremes of the party, so that fights among Democrats tend to drive their candidates to the left because that's where their activist base is, just like among Republicans, fights among candidates drive them to the right, and that was part of the difficulty for Republicans during the Tea Party phase is that sometimes that ended up producing the primaries would produce a general election candidate who would not be as well fit for a general election and lose you know, promising opportunities to defeat Democrats because they had tacked too far to the right.
How does that get resolved? I mean, where is it necessary to resolve it? You've got some people writing now about a once-in-a-generation reorganization of the American left. That sounds like a big deal. Is it just organically happening, or does it come to a knockdown dragout? Will these primaries among Democrats tell us, or will they be also just checkered because different districts will have different appetites for more or less progressive, contenders?
I would say it's not an organized thing that's going on. I mean, you know how the Democratic Party is not generally very well organized. And I think the progressive left also, it's a very decentralized, grassroots kind of spontaneous things that's going on. So there's nobody who's going to sit in the middle of one congressional district or sit at the DCCC and say, I think this is the kind of candidate who's going to win, and we're just going to put all these chess pieces on the board. I think that there's an institutional bias in part among party leaders to try to find more pragmatic centrist candidates. I think the DCCC has been a little bit more reluctant to weigh in early, precisely because the energy of the party is coming from the left. And I think if they too heavily favor somebody in a competitive primary, it could backfire on the candidate if progressive activists see them as a candidate as a pawn of the establishment.
But without clarity, you quote Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO, saying, when you ask people what the Democrats stand for, there's a pause and a silence. That sounds like a problem.
Yes, it was a very powerful observation on his part. And I think each candidate now has to kind of be able to give a quick answer to what they stand for.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire, but short on time? You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Democratic Party's battles within as Democrats prepare for the 2018 elections and beyond. It's not just Republicans fighting over the soul of their party. The Sanders camp versus the Clinton camp and more in the Democratic Party. Janet Hook has been writing about it for the Wall Street Journal. You can link to her story at our website. Democrats are united against Trump, divided on everything else. It's at onpointradio.org. Find a link straight to it there. And you can join us this hour. Is there a real fight yet to be had over where the Democratic Party goes, what it stands for? And since Clinton's loss a year ago, do you see a party that's woken up, gotten in touch with more voters, sees what's going on, gets it? We've listened as Democrats work on this. This was Chuck Schumer in July talking with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week. George asked him about a poll showing that 52% of Americans thought Democrats stand against Donald Trump but not for something. Here's what Schumer had to say.
It is in part our fault. When you lose an election with someone who has, say, 40% popularity, you look in the mirror and say, what did we do wrong? And the number one thing that we did wrong is we didn't tell people what we stood for. Even today, as your poll showed, they know we're standing up to Trump. They like that. But they want to know, what do you stand?
What's the voice of that going to be? A lot of Democrats say they see maybe the kind of candidate they need in, as Janet Hook said, Randy Bryce, 52-year-old Wisconsin iron worker who goes by the nickname Iron Stash, hopes to unseat Speaker of the House Paul Ryan in the next midterms. Here's part of one of his ads.
I decided to run for office because not everybody's seated at the table, and it's time to make a bigger table. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C. We can do so much better together as a community. Our future depends on it.
Randy Bryce, Iron Stash, hoping to unseat Paul Ryan. Well, we'll see. Janet, it's interesting. I mean, many hours before we've gone to air, our social media just full of people coming in to talk about this, a lot of passion for what the Democrats need to do. And you know, we've talked for weeks about Republicans debating whether the Republican Party ought to go, whether it's Donald Trump's party or not. But there's a big old debate on the Democratic side of the ledger as well. Please stand by there in Washington, Jen. I want to bring in Karen Bernal. She's a delegate representing Sacramento County to the California State Democratic Party, member of the party's executive board there, and co-author of a report released just this week, headline Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. Karen Bernal, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Who's put this autopsy together?
Well, I, along with Norman Solomon and Sam McCann and Pia Gallegos, four of us writing, and the advice of a lot of progressive Democratic activists.
So these are progressives, activists, saying autopsy. Autopsy suggests a dead body. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's quite common for the party to do an autopsy after an election, but we did note that
after an election defeat, I would say, right?
Well, oftentimes in politics, you have a debriefing, a postmortem on what occurred. In this regard, you know, it's often referred to as an autopsy, sometimes a postmortem. Yes, you can read into the word autopsy here, and I think it's apt. But we did note that this time around, the party did not, in any official way, have an autopsy report or postmortem report. And we felt that if of all the elections, this one was truly monumental and really called for one. So we put it together. And really, we did this because none of us want to see a repeat of what occurred. And we felt that if we are going to make needed changes in 2018 and 2020, we needed to really be clear-eyed about what happened.
So this is a progressive indictment, William Grider calls it, in The Nation. He calls your report a text for rebellion and a rough suggestion of what a born-again Democratic Party might look like. He points to one of your central conclusions where you say Democrats will not win if they continue to bring a wonk knife to a populist gunfight. What do you mean?
Well, we just earlier in the program, we talked about how simply opposing Trump isn't enough. The party actually has to stand for something. And part of that means that they need to be very clear about their platform. We have a new generation of voters coming up. And to be quite honest, they are very highly attuned to a kind of knowing about when something seems faux and when something is very real. And the party needs to put its cards on the table, and it needs to come out with a clear progressive agenda.
You write, the idea that the Democrats can somehow convince Wall Street to work on behalf of Main Street through mild chiding rather than acting as Main Street's champion against the wealthy no longer resonates. Is that a rejection of kind of a Hillary Clinton approach to politics? Are you saying embrace the Bernie Sanders way?
Well, yes. And I mean, let's look at some things here. We know, for instance, in a January 2017 poll showing 43% of voters under 30 had a very favorable opinion towards socialism versus only 26 unfavorable. What that is telling you is that the young voters are increasingly more left-wing than their counterparts a generation ago on political and social issues. And we all know that when it came to 2016, in addition to the people of color vote, which was significantly down, it's shocking to know that 8% of voters under age 30 cast ballots for a third-party presidential candidate. And as NPR itself reported some time ago, in some battleground states, that number was much, much higher.
Jen and Hook, you're listening here. If the party decided to go much stronger left, you're writing about strategy and mission. What would it mean for strategy and mission, Janet?
Well, I think those are two questions. Well, strategy and agenda are two different things.
Yeah.
I think that the strategy of tacking to the left is one that would clarify the party's message if you kind of – everybody kind of got fully on board with Medicare for all, free public college tuition. Those are very, very clear messages. I think it's not totally clear that there's a majority in America that supports those that agenda. And so to a certain extent, especially in battleground districts, you have to choose between clarity of message and trying to figure out what the winning strategy would be. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of an the theory among Bernie Sanders supporters is that if you have a clearer message, you know, a stronger message, you mobilize new voters and more voters, and you kind of create a majority rather than you create and mobilize a majority rather than persuading a majority.
And Karen? Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, the recent Harvard-Harris poll, which polled registered Democrats. So this is going now from, you know, truly the partisan left to registered Democrats, found that 52% of registered Democrats want the party to move in a more progressive direction. I think that we can see here that that this has had a profound effect on a lot of the electorate when presented with a new agenda, a progressive agenda, that it has been positively responded to, and we find broad agreement on many of these things. And I think if the party is to determine how to truly connect with this universe of voters, again, now 52%, they have to grasp that the high support for Sanders from those voters in the 2016 primaries and his enduring popularity, even now, are markers for a sustained progressive wave. And the party can either learn to ride that wave or choose to duck under it, but they're not going to avoid it.
Karen Bernal, please stand by there. One of the co-authors of this new so-called or titled Autopsy, The Democratic Party in Crisis, Seeing Go More Progressive, Janet Hook with The Wall Street Journal. Michael Tomasky joins us right now from Washington. He's editor of Democracy, Journal of Ideas, columnist for The Daily Beast. He had been a strong Hillary supporter. Michael Tomasky, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So here the Democrats are. A whole lot of fire in the belly to resist Donald Trump, to try and take back majorities in the House and maybe the White House as well in 2020. Who knows? But what about the posture, the thrust here? Is Karen right? Go progressive, go liberal, no holds barred, and that's the way to win.
Well, it depends on win what. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. I would say, first of all, Tom, I wouldn't minimize the party's problems. When you lose an election like that to a guy like that, it's a pretty sobering thing. And then if you look down at the state level and the number of governors' mansions and state legislatures that the Republicans control, the Democrats have really serious problems there. Having said that, you know, at the presidential level, the loss was, shocking though it was quite narrow. It's 77,000 voters in three states. There's a temptation to overreact to that. Now, I agree with the clip that you played of Chuck Schumer and what Schumer said about, and I think Clinton can be faulted for a lack of a really clear and forceful economic message, particularly in those three states. I mean, of course, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. But, you know, it's not like the Democrats have to... you know, it's not like she got slaughtered, and she won the popular vote, and you know, they have to fix some things, but they could also overcompensate. That's the presidential level.
I mean, you don't have state legislatures, you don't have Congress, you don't have the White House, but you think you can sort of muddle through? Is that what that means?
No, I'm not. I didn't say muddle through.
Well,
I'm just saying that she didn't lose by much, and you know, they don't need to do a wholesale. Oh my God! You know, it's shocking that they lost,
mm-hmm.
and they need to recognize that. But the scope of the loss, mm-hmm. in a certain sense, is manageable. Now I want to talk about the House for a second.
Okay.
Here's the fact: the Republicans can gain a House majority of 218 or greater with only conservatives. The Democrats can't gain a House majority of 218 or greater with only liberals. They just can't. There aren't that many liberal districts in the country. there are around, defining liberal fairly generously, 180 or 185 liberal districts in the United States. So if the Democrats are going to get that majority and win House districts in states like Arizona and North Carolina and Colorado and Virginia that they won back in 2006 and 2008, New Mexico, some other states, they're going to have to run, as Janet Hook said earlier, a range of candidates that span a certain ideological spectrum. There's just no way around that if they want to get a House majority.
Karen, are you on board with that? The country's politics are dappled. They're not consistent across the country. The Democrats have to be more than one thing or can't just go progressive?
By and large, what we can see across the board is that there needs to be an acknowledgement of class consciousness in all of the messaging, whether we're talking about suburbia, the rural America, or urban areas with a majority people of color, for instance. Now, it may impact it. Impacts all of those communities differently, of course. And this is where I think where the variance can come in. But I think the common thread between them is the fact that there needs to be a class consciousness in its ideology and messaging. I want to remind everyone that not so long ago, it was Chuck Schumer who said, quote, "For every blue-collar Democrat we lose in western Pennsylvania, we will pick up two moderate Republicans in the suburbs in Philadelphia." And he went on to say, and you can repeat that in Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin, and we know how that turned out. We also know that, by 2032, the people of color will become a majority of the American working class. And this is for the prime age working class cohort between 25 and 54 years of age. This shift will occur even faster among the young. And for the workers between 25 and 34, the projected transition year is 2021, just a year after the presidential election. So to that extent, this idea of siloing, the silo politics of the working class, often code for white voters and people of color, are going to intersect. And therefore, much of the concerns, race and gender meeting with class politics, that is coming together. And when we look at that, what that tells us is that, yes, this is going to move very much to the left, ideologically, and along the socioeconomic lines. We write about this extensively in The Autopsy, which if listeners want to check it out, it's at democraticautopsy.org.
Janet Hook, you're listening to this. Can the Democrats, can they go strongly left, as Karen describes, and win? Can they have more than one tune they're playing, or a kind of a hybrid, as Michael suggests, and win? Can they count on rising minorities to bail them out?
Well, I do think that it's almost inevitable that the Democrats will be choosing a patchwork of messages. As I said before, mm-hmm. the congressional districts that are up and swing districts that they'll be fighting over just all have very different kind of political dynamics. I do think that the range, though, has generally moved to the left. I think Bernie Sanders has had a big impact. I think you'll see it most clearly in the presidential candidate field, and you see it already when Bernie Sanders introduced his Medicare for All bill. He had a bevy of potential 2020 presidential candidates endorsing it. So I actually think that to the extent that the debate that's going on now is driven by the Trump victory, there are two things that occur to me. The margin was close, but for me on Election Day, the question, or the day after Election Day, the question wasn't why did Hillary lose, but why was it so close in the first place? I mean, this was a candidate. Remember what we thought of Donald Trump before he won. He just seemed like that it was unwinnable and that he wasn't equipped to be president. It was amazing that it came that close. And so then the last 70,000 or so votes that put him over the top wasn't as interesting to me as the broader dynamic.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Democratic Party's battles within as Democrats prepare for the 2018 elections and beyond. It's not just Republicans fighting over the soul of their party. You've got the Sanders camp, the Clinton camp, and more at work in the Democratic Party. Different visions of what the strategy should be, what the mission should be. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Bernie Sanders has been very prominent. Is he going to be the tentpole of this party going forward? Does it have to be a progressive party, a centrist party? Can it be both? Janet Hook is with us from the Wall Street Journal. She's been writing compellingly about this. Karen Bernal is with us, one of the co-authors of a new so-called autopsy title, headline, The Democratic Party in Crisis, sort of looking at what went wrong and prescribing a very progressive way forward. Michael Tomasky is here, editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas. He's been a Hillary Clinton supporter, looking at everything that's going on right now. Democrats trying to clarify their message and come back after that stunning loss of the White House that many did not anticipate, even within the GOP. This was in July, that famous press conference in Berryville, Virginia. Democrats gathered to talk about a new, better deal. Here was a minority leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer.
Too many Americans don't know what we stand for. Not after today. President Trump campaigned on a populist platform, talking to working people. That's why he won. But as soon as he got into office, he abandoned them.
And what exactly will the Democrats stand for? Bernie Sanders is still out there pushing hard for single-payer health care coverage. He calls it Medicare for All. Brought it back in September. Here he was saying he's got a record level of support from Democrats.
I am just very excited about the kind of support our Medicare for All legislation is receiving all across this country and right here in the United States Senate. As of today, we now have 16 co-sponsors on this legislation.
And you hear the celebration there. Will that work in 2018 at the polls? In 2020, lots of callers for the three of you, Janet, Karen, Michael. Joyce is calling from Picayune, Mississippi. Joyce, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I very much disagree with Michael. I think that the Democrats cannot win. That's why Hillary Clinton lost, is because they run on a lukewarm platform. If the Democrats don't stand for anything, then they'll fall every time. And also, Hillary Clinton lost. Why is she still so popular in the Democratic Party? There's a reason she lost. It's because the Democrats are very weak and they're vindictive. They kick out people in their own party who are trying to make a difference just for money. And I don't understand why we're still in the same place that we are, even though the country wants to move in a very left.
Joyce, what do you mean by a lukewarm platform?
They don't stand for anything. I don't see anything. When I go and look at a Democratic candidate, I don't see anything in them like I did with Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. It's just about money and the donors, and it just doesn't seem like they really care about their constituents anymore.
I'll put that to Michael Tomasky. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, and I'll put it all to our guest, Brian in Clinton, Iowa. Brian, you're on the air. Thank you, Joyce. Brian, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I kind of agree with the last caller. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter, and I think that it's almost either a generational thing or people that have been involved in politics so long that they just follow the Democratic Party no matter what the message is. The Democrats in my area in Iowa were all about Bernie Sanders because he wasn't so against guns. I mean, there's hunters around here, but some of them went Donald Trump because he was pro-job. But as soon as he started messing with the EPA, they didn't like him anymore. So it needs to be something that we can come together on and not have such a hard line against maybe the guns and a harder line against for pro-environment stuff. You know, that to get the younger generation into it. That's just my personal opinion from what I experienced when I was campaigning for Bernie Sanders.
And what about whether the party should be more progressive or more centrist to win and to govern?
I just think the message needs to be clear and in a reasonable way. I mean, I just don't think that we can constantly say, you know what, gun laws are going to be like this, and in the, I don't think that everybody's agreeing in the Democratic Party on a level that we can come together. And I don't know if it's a generation thing. I don't know if it's because the Democrats that are from, you know, 30 years ago that are still voting that are voting just because it's Democrat, or if they're thinking critically. Younger people, I think more critically about what they're going to vote for than a older generation of voter. That's just what I experienced when I was working for Bernie Sanders to become president.
We've got it. Brian, I appreciate your call. Michael Tomasky, what about it? Do you have a generational problem or divide in the Democratic Party? And what about Joyce in Mississippi saying it can't be lukewarm? And she was sort of tagging Hillary Clinton's positions as lukewarm.
Yeah. There's something of a generational divide. There's no question about that. And I think Karen described it well. You know, I think a lot of this just comes down to style. You know, Bernie burns really hot, and Bernie speaks in moral absolutes, and Clinton did not, and she does not. And she speaks, you know, in the policy specifics and nuance, and that's not as big a turn-on to a lot of people. I understand that. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at her platform, it was more progressive than Barack Obama's platform in 2008, like by a mile,
mm-hmm.
By a long way, you know, on health care, on paid family leave, which Obama didn't dare support, on several other economic things. She didn't communicate it well. She didn't communicate it well. But it's really not fair or correct to say Democrats don't stand for anything. If they don't communicate what they stand for, that's a fair criticism, and that's a problem. And, you know, I understand why so many people found Bernie so appealing, because of the way he spoke about things, and the Democrats need some more of that. And I'm all for them, by the way, moving to the left in class and economic justice terms. But, you know, I think she got a lot of stuff thrown at her that, you know, really was, you know, she didn't stack up to Bernie rhetorically, and people read a lot of stuff into that that wasn't quite fair.
Karen Bernal, this is about style, or is it about substance?
It's both. I mean, your style comes about, your style is manifested because of the substance that you have. And, you know, I want to say that I think that the caller from, was it Louisiana?
Mississippi.
Mississippi spoke, that is the discontent that is out there. And it's not only there, but let's take, for instance, Hillary's most reliable voting bloc, African-American women. The Democratic Party has experienced an 11% drop in support from black women, according to one survey, while the percentage of black women who said neither party represents them went from 13% in 2016 to 21% in 2017. That is shocking, and this is something that ought to worry the party. And when we talk about being clear, we're not just talking about a style, because it is also about energizing as well as expanding the base of the party. And to do this, we have to do two things, not just fight right-wing efforts to rig who are trying to rig the political system under Trump, but we also need to give people who can vote a truly compelling reason to vote. And we don't do that when we have milquetoast talking points about our policies. The thing about Bernie was that, yes, he was very clear, and it provided a point of reference for the conversation to take place around that. And that is really important. And I'm afraid that Hillary Clinton missed that. And I think that people responded in a way that showed that they did not believe she would be the standard bearer for any kind of progressive change.
Janet Hoke, who stands for the Democratic Party now? Is it Bernie Sanders by default? Is he the biggest tent pole? Can Schumer and Pelosi and company still claim that mantle? Who really speaks for the Democratic Party?
Well, no one. This is always a problem for a party out of power. When you don't have a presidential candidate or a president, there's no sort of single face of the Democratic Party. So you know, there you just have to listen to the voices that matter to you when you're voting. But if I could just step back from kind of the way the conversation has been going here, you know, away from the liberal, progressive, centrist labels, I think Hillary Clinton and the party more broadly had a problem that kind of transcends ideology. It might be related to their policy proposals. It might be related to their communication strategy. But there are a lot of voters out there who just look at Democrats and say, you don't get me. You don't get my day-to-day concerns. You're off in your elite towers. You're all from the East and West Coast. You don't get me. And that made them vulnerable to the Trump pitch, you know, for better or worse. He somehow managed to tell people that he got them. So I think that part of it is just kind of shedding a kind of almost cultural, political cultural burden that Democrats have been bearing of just not really connecting with voters. And I'm not talking about white working class voters. I'm talking about maybe working class voters generally. And part of that can be overcome with political skill. Part of it is style. Like, I think Bernie, because he's kind of blunt and yells and, you know, he just seems like more like a man of the people. So, and I don't think that this is just a superficial thing. I think that Washington, on both in both parties, and I think the Republican base that feels the same way about their party elites, Washington is just removed from the concerns of the country.
Though Donald Trump tapped in there, tapped in enough to win. Let me get one more call, and I'll bring it to you, Michael. Brooks in Winterset, Iowa. Brooks, you're on.
Hi there, Tom. I guess a couple things that I wanted to say was I see the corporatization of the Democratic Party as maybe a problem. You know, we saw that Bill Clinton run on a platform where he raised a lot of money through Wall Street. And then through his era, it's like we saw a progressive weakening of labor unions because the Democrats weren't reliant on them as much. And then really, the GLBA of 99, which was an act that repealed some of Glass-Steagall's, and really a lot of people think that maybe that is what led to the financial crisis of 2008. I wonder if maybe a lot of these workers, the labor that are disgruntled, I mean, that's really what Donald Trump won on, was a bunch of disgruntled workers. And when I was much younger, the Democrats were the party of the working class. It doesn't seem to be that way anymore.
Brooks, let us pick it up. Michael Tomasky, what about the you don't get me complaint that Janet Hook articulates, and our caller saying worrying about the corporatization of the Democratic Party, alignment with Wall Street?
Yeah, these are fair things. And, you know, I think that, you know, the Democrats leaders, you know, and, you know, they're good and effective in a lot of ways, Schumer and Pelosi. But, you know, he's from New York City, Brooklyn, and she's from San Francisco. And you know, you can certainly make an argument that the Democrats need symbolically to have leaders from other parts of the country, from the heartland, from you know, the middle part of the country. And I think there is a sense in which, you know, I don't want to say like the Democrats, because that's too big a blanket indictment. There are a lot of Democrats who represent middle America and rural and exurban districts, and they do it well. And states, Sherrod Brown, for example. But I think it did become true of the Clinton campaign, probably, that it sort of lost contact with that part of America that was feeling left behind, and was just more culturally in contact with the America, you know, the entrepreneurial America, the innovating America, the Silicon Valley America, and you know, wasn't too in touch with you know, Southern Illinois anymore.
But our caller Brooks is not tagging that just on the Clintons. He's saying that the Democratic Party itself didn't have the feeling of being the party that stood with the working person. That alignment with Wall Street seemed to come through. Now you can find plenty of evidence of GOP alignment as well, but Trump, you know, rhetorically spoke in a different way. Can the Democrats pull that off?
Yeah, I think
can they substantially realign?
I think they can. It depends on who the candidate is. I mean, as Janet keeps saying, a lot of this comes down to who the candidate is. You know, they don't need a strong positive message right now. That's not what midterm elections are about. Midterm elections are referendums on the incumbent, and if Trump has a lousy approval rating, they should do pretty well as long as they keep up the resistance and as long as they stay unified in fighting Trump. Then after that, it's going to be presidential candidates are going to start lining up, and then they'll have the real internal battle about what direction they're going to go and who their leader is going to be, and we'll see if that person can connect.
Janet, the President Trump's approval rating hit an all-time low for his presidency this week, very low across all presidents at this time in their first term in office. What about 2018 prospects, given that? Is there a shoe-in for the Dems there?
Well, it's not a shoe-in, but Michael's right in pointing out that probably nothing matters more in the trajectory of a midterm election than the presidential approval rating. Also, historically, usually the president's first midterm after he's elected, his party does badly or loses seats. There's only a few exceptions to that. So, you know, all of the expectations are is there, that the approval rating and the historical precedent works in the Democrats' favor. I personally have been so humbled by the developments of the last presidential election, I can't bear to make any predictions anymore. So,
if they don't resolve the bigger issues, thematic issues here until the presidential campaign, is there time for them to come to the electorate with a clear message if that's put off until the 2020 campaign?
Oh, sure. Believe me, they're going to be campaigning for president for much longer than you want them to.
So right in front of us, maybe.
Right.
And right. Soon.
It'll come soon. And by the time it's all over, you'll feel like it's been a decade.
Well, we'll see what comes in that season about clarity, about alignment, and how it aligns with the American voter. Janet Hook with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for your work and for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Karen Bernal, representing Sacramento's County to the California State Democratic Party, co-author of the new Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. Karen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Michael Tomasky, editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for all your robust commentary online. Check it out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.